snapped up fast. Myra Witkowski could snap him up in an instant if I let her.
Remember, I'm looking for Simon Diggory. Check out Milton's jewelry for me, and let me know if he's going in the ground with anything pricey enough to get Diggory out to the cemetery on a cold night.
Morelli and Bob strolled in a little after 6. Morelli shucked his boots and jacket in the foyer and dumped a grocery bag and a six-pack onto the counter. He grabbed me and kissed me and cracked open a beer from the six-pack.
I'm starving, he said. I didn't have time for lunch.
I pulled a bunch of chili dogs and a bucket of cheese fries out of the grocery bag. I put 2 dogs and some fries in a bowl for Bob and unwrapped a dog for myself. This is what I love about you, I said to Morelli. No vegetables. Morelli ate some hot dog and drank some more beer.
Is that all you love about me?
No, but it's high on the list.
The Berenger murders are going into the toilet. The security company didn't have film in any of the surveillance cameras. Everyone hated the 2 people who were killed. It was cold and overcast, and there was no exterior lighting in the back of the building. No one saw anything. No one heard anything. Forced entry. Nothing stolen.
Maybe you should hire a psychic.
I know you're being a wise ass, but I'm about at that point.
What's happening with Dickie? Am I still a suspect?
Right now, Dickie is just a missing person who disappeared under suspicious circumstances. If his body floats in on the tide, you could be in trouble. Marty Goebel is still the primary investigator, and he wants to talk to you first thing tomorrow. I gave him your cell number.
Do you think I should use the orgasm defense?
Yeah, my reputation could use a boost.
Morelli finished off his 2nd hot dog and ate some fries.
I'm not on the case, but I've been poking around on my own, and I don't like Dickie's partners. I'm probably going to regret saying this, but maybe you should bring Ranger in. He can do things I can't. Ranger doesn't mind bending the law to get information. Have him take a look at the partners.
You're worried about me. Morelli wiped his hands on his jeans and pulled me to him, wrapping his arms around me.
Dickie was a respected lawyer, and Joyce is making a lot of noise. This is going to go high profile, and the politicians will have to point a finger at someone. When the media gets hold of this case, unless new evidence is found, you're going to be in the spotlight.
He rested his cheek on the top of my head.
I can manage the media attention. I couldn't manage having you taken away from me.
I tipped my head back and looked at him. He was serious. Do you think I might be arrested and convicted?
I think the possibility is slim, but I'm not willing to take a chance on it. Ask Ranger for help and keep your head down. Don't do anything to bring more attention to yourself.
I was dragged awake by something ringing in the dark room. Morelli swore softly, and his arm reached across me to the nightstand where he'd left his cell phone.
What?
Morelli said into the phone. Someone was talking on the other end, and I could feel Morelli coming awake.
You're fucking kidding me,
he said to the caller.
Why does this shit always happen in the middle of the night?
I squinted at my bedside clock and grimaced. 3 a.m. Morelli was up and moving around the room, looking for his clothes. He still had the phone to his ear.
Give me an address, he said,
and a moment later he snapped his phone closed. He slipped his watch on his wrist and pulled his jeans on. He sat on the edge of the bed and tugged on socks. He leaned over and kissed me.
I have to go, and I probably won't get back tonight. I'll take Bob with me.
Is this about the Berenger murders?
Someone else was just found dead in the building.
He clipped his gun onto his belt and pulled a sweater over a t-shirt.
I'll call when I can.
I had 1/3 of a jar of peanut butter in my pantry, no milk, no bread, no juice, 1/2 a box of Cheerios. I dropped some Cheerios into Rex's food dish and mixed some up with the peanut butter for myself. I washed the Cheerios and peanut butter down with black coffee and grabbed my coat. Marty Goebel, the cop who was in charge of Dickie's disappearance, was supposed to call to talk. If I wasn't Morelli's girlfriend, I'd probably be getting fingerprinted. Good thing I had something solid in my stomach, because otherwise I might be inclined to throw up. I really didn't want to go to jail. Peter Smullen was first on my list of hideous jobs. According to Ranger's research, Smullen would be rolling into Starbucks a little after 8. I arrived 15 minutes in front of the hour and tried to look inconspicuous by studying the shelves of coffee mugs for sale. Not that inconspicuous was much of a problem. The place was packed, and anyone under 7 feet tall wasn't going to stand out. I saw Smullen push through the door at 5 of 8 and realized I might have a problem. He was buttoned into a black cashmere overcoat. There was no way to drop a bug in his suit pocket.
Fortunately, the store was warm and the line was long. If the line went slow enough, he'd unbutton his coat. I watched from my spot at the front of the store. I had a plan. I was going to wait until he had his coffee, and then I'd approach him. My coat was open, and I was wearing a low-cut V-neck sweater with a push-up bra. I looked pretty good considering my boobs were real, but it was hard to compete with all the double-D silicone jobs. Smullen finally got to the counter and put in his order. He unbuttoned his coat to get his wallet, and I almost collapsed with relief. I had access to his pockets. He shuffled to the pickup counter, got his triple frappuccino, and when he turned toward the door, he was flat against me. I had my boobs pressed into his chest and my leg between his. "Whoops," I said, sliding my hand under his coat, dropping the bug into his pocket. "Sorry." Smullen didn't blink. He just hung on to his frappuccino like this happened every morning. And maybe it did. There were a lot of people in the store. I took one step back and one step to the side to let Smullen get past me, and Smullen inched his way toward the door and disappeared. I felt someone lean into me from behind, and a coffee was placed in my hand.
"Nice," Ranger said, guiding me out to the sidewalk. "I couldn't have gotten that close, and he wouldn't have been distracted by my chest."
"I don't think he even noticed."
"A man would have to be dead not to notice," Ranger said.
"Morelli's worried I'll be involved in Dickie's disappearance. He said I should ask you for help."
"He's a good man," Ranger said.
"And you?"
"I'm better."
Lula was filing when I walked into the bond's office. "What's with this?" I asked.
"Huh," Lula said. "You act like I never do nothing. It's just I'm so efficient, I get my work done before anyone notices. My name should be Flash. You ever see any files laying around?"
"I assumed you were throwing them away."
"Your ass," Lula said.
For a short time, we had a guy named Melvin Pickle doing our filing. Pickle was a filing dynamo. Unfortunately, he was so good, he was able to get a better job. Les Sebring hired him to work in his bond's office, and Connie had to coerce Lula to take back filing responsibilities. Connie was carefully adding a top coat to her nails.
"Having any luck with the new batch of FTAs?"
"No, but Milton Busick is getting buried today. I'm waiting to get a jewelry report from Grandma."
"If he got a Rolex on, I don't want to know," Lula said. "Do things I'm not doing. I'm not going back to that trailer, and I'm not sitting in no cemetery. Dead people creep me out."
"What about Carl Coughlin?" Connie asked. "He looks pretty straightforward. He has a small shop attached to his home."
"Who's Carl Coughlin?" Lula wanted to know.
I pulled Carl's file out of my bag and flipped it open. 64 years old, never married, lives alone. His sister put up the bond. Accused of destruction of personal property. Doesn't go into detail. Lists his occupation as taxidermist.
"Taxidermist," Lula said. "We never busted a taxidermist before. It could be fun."
A half hour later, we were in North Trenton, standing in front of Coughlin's house. This was a working-class neighborhood filled with people stretched too thin to plant flowers in the spring. Houses were neat but shabby. Cars were tired. Coughlin lived in a red-brick single-family house with mustard trim. The paint was blistered, and the wood around the windows had some rot. The front porch had been enclosed as an afterthought, and a small sign on the door advertised Coughlin's taxidermy business.
"Don't look to me like taxidermy pays real well," Lula said.
A scrawny little guy answered my knock, and I knew from the picture on file that it was Coughlin. Hair the color and texture of steel wool, wire-rimmed glasses.
"Carl Coughlin?" I asked.
"Yes."
"I represent Vincent Plum bail bonds. You missed your court date last week, and I'd like to help you reschedule."
"That's nice of you," Coughlin said, "but I don't want to inconvenience you."
"It's my job."
"Oh,"
Coughlin said.
"Well, what does this rescheduling involve?"
"You need to go to the courthouse and get rebonded." We were standing in Coughlin's front porch showroom, and it was hard not to notice the animals lining his walls.
"Where's the moose heads?" Lula asked Coughlin. "I thought you taxidermy guys stuffed lions and tigers and shit. All I see is cats and dogs and pigeons."
"This is urban taxidermy," Coughlin said. "I restore pets and found objects."
"What's a found object?"
Lula wanted to know.
"Treasure found in nature. For instance, if you were walking through the park and you found a deceased pigeon, that would be a found object. And sometimes I make performance pieces. The performance pieces are mechanicals. There's a growing market for the mechanicals."
Lula looked at a woodchuck posed on a piece of astroturf. Some of its fur had been worn away, and it had what appeared to be part of a tire track imprinted on its back.
You're a sick man, Lula said.
It's art, Coughlin said. You don't understand art.
I understand roadkill, Lula said.
About that rescheduling, I said to Coughlin.
Maybe I could reschedule next week, Coughlin said. I can't leave now. I have to stay at the house. And I have a fresh opossum on the table.
Oh, boy, Lula said.
It's hard to get an opossum at this time of year, Coughlin said. I was lucky to find it, and it won't be good when it defrosts.
This won't take long, I told him.
You're not going to leave without me, are you?
He asked.
No.
Coughlin looked at his watch.
I suppose I could go with you if this doesn't take long. Let me get my coat and lock the back door. In the meantime, feel free to browse my showroom. All these items are for sale.
I'm glad to hear that, Lula said. I always wanted a stuffed dead dog.
Coughlin disappeared into the house, and I tried not to look too hard at the critters. These animals are creeping me out, I said to Lula. It's like being in a whacked-out pet cemetery.
Yeah,
Lula said.
They've seen better days.
She picked up a stuffed squirrel.
This guy's got three eyes. He must have lived next to the nuclear power plant.
I heard the back door slam, and then a motor crank over.
Car,
I said to Lula. We ran to the back of the house and saw Coughlin pull away in a green Isuzu SUV. We turned and sprinted through the house, out the door to the Vic.
There he goes, Lula said, pointing to the corner. South on centerline.
I had the Vic in gear and moving. I took the corner on two wheels and put my foot to the floor. Coughlin was a block ahead of me.
He's turning,
Lula said.
I'm on it. He's got a light, Lula said. He has to stop for the light.
I jumped on the brake, but Coughlin ran it. He sailed through the light and was lost in traffic.
Guess he didn't feel like going to jail, Lula said.
The light changed and I slowly moved forward. I looked over at Lula and saw she still had the squirrel.
We were in such a rush to get out of the house, I forgot I was holding this here mutant rodent, Lula said.
It doesn't look like a third eye, I said to her. It looks like a switch. Maybe this is a mechanical rodent. Lula pushed the switch and studied it.
It's making a noise. It's sort of ticking. It's
bang! The squirrel exploded. We both shrieked. I jumped the curb and sideswiped a streetlight.
What the fuck?
Lula said. Are you okay?
No, I'm not okay. That squirrel just friggin' blew himself apart on me. I got squirrel guts on me.
Doesn't look like guts, I said, examining the hair and skin plastered to the dashboard. Looks like he was stuffed with some kind of foam that melted when it exploded.
This guy's building rodent bombs, Lula said. We should report him to someone. You can't just go around building rodent bombs, can you?
I backed up and tried to open my door, but it wouldn't open. I rolled the window down, climbed out Dukes of Hazzard style, and examined the damage. Some of the door was bashed in where I'd hit the light. I climbed back into the car and drove off the sidewalk.
I got foam and squirrel hair stuck to me, Lula said. I probably need a rabies shot or something.
Yeah, I said. Problem is, I don't know whether to take you to a veterinarian or an upholsterer.
Smells funky, Lula said, sniffing her finger. What's it smell like?
Squirrel.
I didn't know squirrels had a smell.
This one does, I told her.
I'm gonna need to take this coat to the dry cleaner, and I'm gonna send the bill to that Coughlin freak. He got some nerve exploding a squirrel on me.
You took the squirrel.
Yeah, but it was entrapment. I think I got a case.
Maybe we should go to lunch, I said to Lula. Take your mind off the squirrel.
I could use some lunch.
Do you have any money?
No, Lula said. Do you?
No.
There's only one thing to do then. Senior buffet.
10 minutes later, I pulled into the Costco parking lot.
Where are we going to start? Lula wanted to know, taking a shopping cart.
I'd like to start in produce and then go to the deli and then frozen.
Costco is the all-American free lunch. If you can't afford to buy food, you can buy a minimum membership at Costco and get freebies from the giveaway ladies. You just have to kick your way through the seniors who stand 10 deep around them.
Look over there, Lula said. They got a giveaway lady frying up them little bitty sausages. I love those little sausages.
We had some apple slices dipped in caramel, some carrots and raw broccoli dipped in ranch dressing, some goat cheese, some frozen pizza pieces, some tofu stir fries, some brownie pieces from the bakery, and some of the sausages. We did a test drive on Guatemalan coffee and sparkling apple cider. We used the ladies' room, and we left.
Whoever invented Costco knew what they were doing, Lula said. I don't know what I'd do without my Costco membership. Sometimes I even buy shit there. Costco's got everything. You could buy a casket at Costco.
We got into the Vic, and I drove us back to Coughlin's house. I idled at the curb for a couple minutes, watching to see if anything was going on. Then I motored around the block and took the alley that led to Coughlin's backyard. No car in his parking space, so I parked there.
Gonna see if he's hiding in a closet? Luva asked.
Yep. I knocked on Coughlin's back door and yelled, "Bond enforcement!" No answer. I opened the door and yelled again. Still no answer. I stepped into the kitchen and looked around. It was just as we'd left it over an hour ago, except for the opossum on the kitchen table. The opossum looked like a balloon with feet, and it smelled worse than squirrel. A lot worse.
Whoa, Lula said. He wasn't kidding about this sucker defrosting.
Maybe we should put it in the freezer for him. Lula had her scarf over her nose.
I'm not touching it. Bad enough I got squirrel on me. I don't need no possum cooties. Anyway, it's not going to fit in his freezer the way it's all swelled up.
Coughlin isn't here, I said to Lula. He would have done something with this animal if he'd returned.
Fucking A, Lula said. I'm out of here.
I parked in front of the office behind Lula's Firebird, and Lula and I got out of the Vic and gaped at the telephone pole at the corner. It was plastered with posters of me. It was a candid photo, and the caption read, "Wanted for murder." What the heck, I said. My first reaction was panic deep in my chest. The police were looking for me. That only lasted a moment. This wasn't any sort of official wanted poster. This was made on someone's home scanner and printer. I tore the posters off the pole and looked down the street. I could see posters on a pole half a block away.
There's posters all over the place, Lula said. They're stuck to store windows and they're stuck on parked cars.
She unlocked her Firebird.
I'm going home. I gotta get this squirrel funk off me.
I went into the office and showed Connie the posters.
It's Joyce, Connie said. I saw her putting them up, but I didn't realize what they were.
They're probably all over town. I should probably ride around and take them down, but I have better things to do with my time, like find out who killed Dickie.
Anything I can do to help?
Yes, I need a background search. Joyce says he's worth lots of money. Connie punched his name into one of the search programs, and the screen filled with information.
He leased a $42,000 Audi a year ago. His house is appraised at $350,000, and it's mortgaged to the rafters. No litigation pending against him. Nothing derogatory on file. He's part owner of the building housing his law firm. His partners are also listed as owner. Looks like the building was bought outright.
No mortgage there.
Connie printed the report and passed it over to me. Any calls for me? I asked her.
No, were you expecting calls?
I was supposed to talk to Marty Goebel this morning. I expected him to call my cell. Not that I wanted to talk to Marty Goebel, but it was better than having a warrant issued for my arrest. I dialed Morelli. No answer. Ranger was next up.
Babe, Ranger said.
Anything new on Dickie?
No, but the natives are restless. I can feel Smullen sweating on the bug.
I left the bonds office, climbed into the Vic, and drove to Dickie's house. It was easy to find since it was the only house on his block draped in yellow crime scene tape. It was a large cape with black shutters and a red door. Probably 30 years old, but recently painted. Two-car garage, nicely landscaped, medium-sized lot. Very respectable, if you overlook the tape. I wasn't sure what I'd expected to find, but I'd felt compelled to do a drive-by. Morbid curiosity, I suppose, since Joyce had been impressed with his wealth. As it was, he seemed comfortable, but not excessively rich. I did a mental reenactment of the crime. I imagined the door to Dickie's house open, and Dickie getting dragged out by whoever shot him. There would have been a car in the driveway. Shots were fired a little before midnight, so it was dark, overcast sky, no moonlight. Still, you'd think someone would have at least seen the car leave. If you hear shots fired and you care enough to call the police, you care enough to look out the window. I parked the Vic, crossed the street, and knocked on the door of the house across from Dickie's. The knock was answered by a woman in her 50s. I'm investigating the Orr incident, I told her. I'd appreciate it if you could just answer a few questions for me.
I suppose, but I've already spoken to the police. I don't have much more to say.
You reported the shots?
Yes, I was getting ready for bed. I heard the shots and I thought it was kids. They ride through and shoot at mailboxes. But then when I looked out the window, I saw the car pull out of the Aura driveway. And I saw that the front door to the house was left open.
What did the car look like?
It looked a little like your police car. It was dark out, so I can't be certain, but I think it was that burgundy color. And the shape was similar. I'm not much of a car person. My husband would have known exactly, but he was already in bed. He didn't get to the window in time.
Did you see any people in the car? Did you see the license plate?
No, I just saw the car. It pulled out of the driveway and went north toward 18th Street.
I thanked her and went back to the Vic. I had two means of exit from the Vic. I could crawl across the console and go out the passenger side door, or I could crawl out the driver's side window.
It was easier to crawl out the window, but that meant the window stayed open, and it was freezing cold when I returned to the car. Although, since I had half a rotting squirrel stuck to my dashboard, there was some advantage to the open window.
I'd chosen to do the crawl over the console thing this time so as not to tip off the neighbors I wasn't really a cop. I returned to the Vic, got some heat going, and reviewed my choices. I could take a shot at finding one of the remaining skips.
I could go on a poster hunt.
I could head over to my parents' house and talk to Grandma about Milton Busick. Or I could go home and take a nap. I was leaning toward the nap when my phone buzzed.
"I need help," Grandma said. "I got a hot date tonight with Elmer. We're going to the Rosinski viewing, and I'm thinking I might have to show some skin to keep Elmer away from Loretta Flick. I figure I can open a couple buttons on my blue dress, but I can't get my boobs to stay up. I thought you might be able to help me get one of them push-up bras."
45 minutes later, I had Grandma in the Victoria's Secret's dressing room, trying on push-up bras.
"Okay," Grandma said from the other side of the door. "I got them all lifted up, and they look pretty good, except for the wrinkles."
"I wouldn't worry about the wrinkles," I told her. "It looked to me like Elmer has cataracts."
"Maybe I need one of them thongs to go with this bra," she said.
I didn't want to think about Grandma in a thong.
"Some pretty panties might be better." "As long as they're sexy, I might get lucky tonight."
If she got lucky, Elmer would drop dead before dinner.
"I'll pick out something that will match while you're getting dressed," I told Grandma.
We were at the register with the bra and panties, and I heard something sizzle in my head, and the next thing I knew, I was on the floor, and my lips were tingling.
"What?"
I said. Grandma was bending over me.
"You got zapped by Joyce Barnhart. I heard you go over, and I turned around and saw Joyce standing there with a stun gun. We called the police, but she ran off, dirty rotten coward."
I looked past Grandma and saw the mall rent-a-cop nervously looking down at me.
"Are you okay?" he asked. "We got a doctor coming."
"Get me up on my feet," I said.
I don't know if I should," he said. "Maybe you should just lay there until help gets here."
"Get me up," I yelled at him. "I don't need a doctor. I need a new car and a new job and 10 minutes alone with Ranger. This is all his fault." The rent-a-cop got me under my armpits and hoisted me up. I went down to my knees, grabbed hold of his shirt, and pulled myself up again.
"Geez, lady," he said.
"Don't worry," I told him. "This happens to me a lot. I'm good at it." Grandma led me through the mall, and we managed to get to the parking lot in the Vic without the doctor finding me. I was supposed to be keeping a low profile. I didn't want to find myself on the evening news. Local bounty hunter stun-gunned in mall, details at 8. Grandma stood back and looked at my car.
"Was your car decorated like this when we left it? I don't remember all this writing on it."
Someone had spray-painted pig car in black and white on the passenger side door and trunk lid.
"It's new," I said. "I would have used brighter colors," Grandma said. "Gold would have looked good. You can't go wrong with gold."
"The black and white goes better with the squirrel hair stuck to the dash," I told her.
"I was wondering what that was," Grandma said. "I figured it was one of the new animal print decorator schemes."
"Lula helped me with it."
"Isn't she the one?" Grandma said.
I got behind the wheel and motored out of the lot onto the highway.
"Do you hear a grinding sound?" Grandma asked.
"All cars sound like that," I said. "You're just noticing it because I don't have the radio on loud enough. What about Milton? Did you notice if he was wearing jewelry?"
"Nothing worth anything. His lodge lapel pin. That was about it."
"I know you're looking for Simon Diggory."
"It'll take something good to get him out in this weather. I'll check out Harry Rosinski, but he probably won't have anything worth taking, and he's not Diggory size."
"Do you need a ride tonight?"
"No, Elmer has a car. He's picking me up."
It was a little after 4 when I dropped Grandma off. Lights were on in Berg houses, and tables were being set for dinner. This was a community where families still sat together for meals. I turned right onto Hamilton, and 10 minutes later, I was in my apartment building. I let myself in, and Bob rushed over to me.
Where's Joe? I asked him.
Not in the kitchen, not in the dining room, not in the living room. I went to the bedroom and found him asleep in my bed.
Hey, Goldilocks, I said.
Morelli came awake and rolled onto his back.
What time is it?
4:30. Have you been here long?
Couple hours.
I heard a news report on the Berenger murders while I was in the car. They said the police were baffled.
Baffled and tired. I need some sleep. I'm too old for this middle-of-the-night murder shit.
There was a time when you did all sorts of things in the middle of the night.
Come here and you can tell me about them.
I thought you were tired.
I just want to talk,
Morelli said. That's a big fib. I know what you want to do. Morelli smiled.
Hard for a man to keep a secret.
Chapter 4 Morelli was at my kitchen counter drinking coffee, eating cereal. His hair was still damp from the shower, and he was clean-shaven. In 10 minutes, he'd have a 5 o'clock shadow. He was wearing worn-out black jeans, a pale gray cable-knit sweater, and black motorcycle boots. You don't look like a cop, I told him. All the other guys wear suits.
I've been asked by the chief not to wear a suit. I look like a casino pit boss when I wear a suit. I don't inspire trust.
I poured myself a bowl of cereal and added milk. It was nice of you to bring all this food.
Your cupboards were empty and your refrigerator. I'm guessing the bounty hunter business is slow.
It comes and goes. Problem is, I only make enough money to live day by day. I can't make enough to get ahead.
It would be easier if you moved in with me.
We've tried that. It's always a disaster. Eventually, we drive each other nuts.
It's your job, Morelli said.
It's your expectations. He put his cereal bowl in the sink and buckled his gun onto his belt.
Yeah, my expectations are that you'll give up your job.
Are we fighting?
Am I yelling and waving my arms?
No.
Then we aren't fighting.
He crooked an arm around my neck and kissed me.
I have to go. I'm working with Phil Panchek. He hates being baffled without me.
Marty Goebel never called to talk to me. Does that mean I'm off the hook?
No. It means he's dreading talking to you for fear you don't have an alibi, and he's procrastinating as long as possible.
Bob was leaning against me. Are you taking Bob?
Yeah, I'll drop him off at my house. He has a routine. He eats the couch, he takes a nap. He gnaws on a dining room table leg, he takes a nap. He spreads the garbage all over the kitchen floor, he takes a nap.
I fondled Bob's ear. You're lucky you have a dog who can amuse himself while you're gone. Morelli shrugged into his jacket and clipped Bob's leash on him.
Later.
I finished my coffee and cereal and hand-washed the dishes. I took a shower and put in the minimum effort on my hair. Truth is, the minimum effort isn't that far removed from the maximum effort, and my hair pretty much looks the same no matter what I do with it. I applied some mascara and looked myself in the eye in the mirror. Today is the day, I said to myself. Time to get serious. If you don't catch someone soon, you'll get kicked out of your apartment. I got dressed in my lucky jeans and my lucky black sweater. It was still cold, but it wasn't snowing or sleeting, so I traded my fake Uggs for running shoes, just in case I had to chase down Diggory. I had cuffs in my back jeans pocket, pepper spray in my jacket pocket, a stun gun clipped to my belt. I went to the kitchen and took my gun out of my cookie jar. It was a little 5-shot Smith & Wesson. I spun the barrel. No bullets. I looked in the jar. No bullets. I rummaged through kitchen drawers. No bullets. I put the gun back in the cookie jar. I didn't really want to shoot anyone today anyway. I got bundled up in my parka and scarf and gloves and went out to the Vic. I crawled in and plugged the key into the ignition. It took a while, but the engine finally caught. All right, so I didn't have a great car. No big deal, I told myself. At least it was running. And today was the day it was all gonna turn around. I was going after Diggory first, and then Coughlin. And then I was gonna plow through the rest of the cases. I took Broad and headed for Bordentown. It was just past rush hour, and traffic was heavy, but moving. The cloud cover had finally lifted, and the sky was as blue as it gets in Jersey. I was on Route 206, cruising along, listening to the radio, when the grinding sound coming from under the hood turned into bang, 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 and the car coasted to a stop at the side of the road. It wasn't entirely unexpected, but it left me breathless all the same. Another example that sugar isn't pixie dust, and wish as hard as you might, it won't make you invisible. I was sitting there trying to keep from crying, running through my options, and Ranger called.
Babe, you're stopped on Route 206. What's up?
I remembered the gizmo in my bag. Range man was monitoring me. My car died. 15 minutes later, I looked in my rearview mirror and saw Ranger pull in behind me. He got out of his car and into mine. Ranger didn't smile a lot, but clearly he was amused.
I don't know how you do it, Ranger said. In a matter of days, you've managed to turn a perfectly good piece of shit car into something so fucked up it's a work of art.
It's a gift.
The bullet hole in the rear window?
Joyce Barnhart, I told him. She's unhappy with me because she thinks I killed Dickie.
And the crud on the dash?
Squirrel bomb. He looked incredulous for a moment, and then burst out laughing. In all the time I've known Ranger, this was maybe the third time I've seen him actually laugh out loud, so it turned out to be worth getting squirrel bombed.
Ranger dropped back to a smile and tugged me out of the car.
He kicked the door closed, slung an arm around my shoulders, and walked me back to his Porsche Cayenne.
Where were you going?
I'm looking for Simon Diggory, I said. I stopped by his double wide on Tuesday, but no one was home. I thought I'd try again.
Ranger opened the Cayenne door for me.
I'll go with you. If we're lucky, we might get to see a snake eat a cow.
I looked back at the Vic. What about my car?
I'll have it picked up.
Ranger didn't bother parking out of sight of Diggory's trailer. He drove the Cayenne onto the blighted grass and pulled up between the trailer and the stand of hardwoods. We got out of the Porsche, and he gave me his gun.
Stay here and shoot anyone who makes a run for it, including the snake.
How do you know I don't have my own gun?
Do you?
No. Ranger did another one of those almost sighing things and jogged to Diggory's front door. I heard him rap on the door and call out. There was the sound of the rusted door opening and closing, and then silence. I held my ground. After a couple minutes, Ranger reappeared and motioned for me to join him.
Simon is off somewhere, but the uncle is here, and stay away from the sink, Ranger said.
I gave him his gun back, followed him into the trailer, and immediately checked out the kitchen area. The snake was sprawled on the counter, its head in the sink. I guess it was thirsty. The uncle was at the small built-in table. The uncle wasn't much older than Simon Diggory, and the family resemblance was there, blurred over a little by hard drinking and an extra 50 pounds. He was wearing black socks and ratty bedroom slippers and huge boxer shorts.
Give you a quarter if you take your shirt off, Bill Diggory said to me.
I'll give you a quarter if you put your shirt on, I told him. Ranger was against the wall watching Diggory.
Where's Simon? Ranger asked.
Dunno,
Bill said.
Think about it, Ranger told him.
He might be at work.
Where's he working?
Dunno.
Ranger's eyes flicked to the snake and back to Bill.
Has he been fed today?
He don't eat every day, Bill said. He probably ain't hungry.
Steph, Ranger said, wait outside so I can talk to Bill.
You aren't going to feed him to the snake, are you?
Not all of him.
As long as it's not all of him, I said, and I let myself out. I closed the door and waited for a couple minutes. I didn't hear any screams of pain or terror, no gunshots. I hunkered down in my jacket and shoved my hands into my pockets to keep warm. A couple more minutes passed, and Ranger came out and closed the door behind him. Well, I asked.
Simon is working in the food court at Quaker Bridge Mall. Bill didn't know more than that.
Did you feed Uncle Bill to the snake?
No. He was right. The snake wasn't hungry.
Then how did you get him to talk? Ranger slid an arm around me, and I felt his lips brush my ear when he spoke.
I can be very persuasive.
No kidding. Quaker Bridge is on Route 1 northeast of Trenton. It seemed like a long way for Diggory to drive for an odd job in a food court, but what the heck? Maybe Diggory was lucky to get it, and maybe he had a better car than I did. That thought brought me up to a sobering reality. Diggory for sure had a better car than I did because I had no car at all. Ranger drove out of Diggory's neighborhood and headed north. We were on Route 206, and I was dreading the section of highway where I'd left the Vic. I didn't want to see the poor, sad, broken-down car. It was a reminder of what was wrong with my life. Crappy job, hand-to-mouth existence, no future I was willing to commit to. If it was June and the sun was shining, I might feel differently. But it was cold, and the clouds had returned, and a mist had started to fall. I need macaroni and cheese, I said to Ranger, clapping my hands over my eyes. I promised myself French fries, jelly donuts, birthday cake, and I never got it.
I have a better way to make you happy, Ranger said.
Less fattening, but more addicting.
Pharmaceuticals?
Sex. And you can open your eyes. The Vic's gone.
Gone where?
Car heaven.
20 minutes later, Ranger stopped at a light on Broad, and his cell buzzed. He answered on a Bluetooth earpiece and listened for a couple minutes, his mood somber, his expression not showing anything. He thanked the caller and disconnected.
They found the accountant, Ziggy Zabar, Ranger said. He washed ashore about a quarter mile south of the Ferry Street Bridge. He was identified by a credit card and a medic alert bracelet for a heart condition.
Ranger parked behind the ME truck, and we walked the distance to the crime scene. It was turning into a miserable day, and the weather was holding the crowd down. Only a few hardy photographers and reporters. No gawkers. A handful of uniforms, a couple plainclothes guys. An EMS team that looked like they wanted to be somewhere else. No one I recognized. We ducked under the yellow tape and found Tank. Tank is Ranger's next in command, and his shadow. No need to describe him. His name says it all. He was dressed in rangeman black, and he looked impervious to the weather.
Tank was with Ziggy Zabar's brother, Zip, also in rangeman black, his face stoic, his posture rigid.
We picked the call up from police dispatch, Tank said. He's been on the water a while, and he's not in great shape, but I've looked at him, and even in his condition, it's obvious it was an execution. Single bullet, nice and clean in the forehead. He's wearing an ankle shackle, so I'm guessing he was attached to something heavy, and the tide broke him loose.
I sucked in some air. I didn't know Ziggy Zabar, but it was horrible all the same.
We stayed for a while, keeping Zip company while he watched over his dead brother. The police photographer left, and the EMS guys came in with a body bag. I could hear the motor running on the ME's truck at the top of the hill. The uniforms had their collars turned up and were shuffling their feet.
The mist had turned into a drizzle.
Ranger was wearing his SEAL ball cap. He tucked my hair behind my ears and put his hat on my head to keep me dry.
You look like you need that birthday cake.
I'd settle for a peanut butter sandwich and some dry socks.
I want to talk to the ME, and then I have some things to do.
He handed me the keys to the Cayenne.
Use my car. I can ride with Tank and Zip. I don't care if you destroy the car, but take care of the hat. I want it back.
I scrambled up the hill, hoisted myself into the Porsche, and turned the heat on full blast. I pulled off the service road onto Broad, and my cell phone buzzed. It was Marty Goebel.
I need you to come in and make a statement, Marty said. I know this isn't anything you want to do, but I can't put it off any longer.
That's okay, I told him. I understand. I'll be there in 10 minutes.
The cop shop is on Perry Street. Half the building is the courthouse, and half the building is a police station. It's red brick, and the architecture could best be categorized as utilitarian municipal. Money wasn't wasted on fancy columns or art. This is strictly a 60-watt building. Still, it serves its purpose, and it's in a neighborhood where it's convenient for the police to find crime. I parked in the public lot across the street and stowed the pepper spray, handcuffs, and stun gun in the console. I applied fresh lip gloss and went to talk to Marty. I crossed the lobby to the cop in a cage and gave him my name. Court was in session across the hall, and people were milling around waiting to pass through security. Marty met me in the lobby. We got coffee and found an empty room where he could take my statement.
So, Marty said when we were seated, why did you kill Dickie Orr?
I felt my mouth drop open and my eyes go wide. Marty gave a bark of laughter.
I'm just fucking with you, he said. The guys made me do it.
Should I have an attorney present? I asked him.
Do you have one?
My brother-in-law.
Oh, geez, are you talking about Albert Clown? He chases ambulances. He paid for his law degree with chickens. Got it somewhere in the islands, right?
I did some mental knuckle cracking. What do you want to know? Do you have an alibi? Oh, boy.
An hour later, I pushed my chair back. I'm done, I told Goebel. And if you want any more from me, you'll have to feed me.
The best I could do is a Snickers bar.
Goebel closed his notepad.
I'm done anyway. You and Morelli aren't planning on going out of the country anytime soon, are you?
I slanted my eyes at him. What are you saying?
Well, you know, you're kind of a suspect. Actually, you're our only suspect.
What's my motive?
You hated him.
Everybody hated him.
Not true, not everybody. And you stand to inherit a lot of money. He had a will drawn up when you were married and it never got changed. You get everything.
What?
I said it on a whoosh of air because it literally knocked the wind out of me.
You didn't know?
I don't believe it. This was the most contentious divorce in the history of the Berg. The shouting was heard for miles. We called each other names that didn't even exist.
Believe it, Marty Goebel said.
How do you know about the will? Aren't wills secret?
Not this one. His girlfriend has a copy, Joyce Barnhart. He was in the process of changing it so she would be his sole heir, but he never signed it.
You're kidding again, right? This is another joke.
Swear to God, if they ever find his body, you'll be rich. Of course, you might not be in a good position to enjoy it.
I left Goebel, locked myself in the Cayenne, and called Morelli. Did you know I was Dickie's sole heir? I asked him.
No. How did you find that out?
Goebel, Joyce told him. Apparently she has a copy of Dickie's will.
So you talked to Marty. How'd it go?
By the time we were done, I was sort of feeling I might have killed Dickie. There was a moment of silence.
You didn't, did you?
No, yeesh. I'm going home. I'm all discombobulated.
Look in the freezer when you get home. I got you happy food.
How happy?
Stouffer's macaroni and cheese, the family size.
I love you. I could feel Morelli smile at the other end.
I own you now. I know where all the buttons are.
I rushed home and went straight to the freezer. I yanked the door open and there it was, the family size. I almost fainted from joy. I popped it into the microwave and ran into the bedroom to get dry clothes. I was changing out of my socks and I realized the room didn't feel exactly right. I'd left the bed unmade and rumpled, and now it was less rumpled, and the pillows were all lined up on the headboard, and my t-shirt drawer was partially open. I moved to the chest beside the bed and got the cylinder of pepper spray from the top drawer. I looked under the bed and in every closet. Didn't find anyone. Whoever had been here was now gone. I called Morelli. I've got it in the microwave, I told him. When did you bring it over?
Yesterday, when I brought all the rest of the stuff. Why?
I think someone was in my apartment when I was gone this morning.
Probably Ranger fingering your underwear.
No, I was with Ranger. And if Ranger was here, I'd never know.
And if Ranger wanted to finger my underwear, he'd do it while I was wearing it. If you're worried, you can move yourself over to my house. Bob loves company.
How about you?
I'd like it too. Just kick the beer cans and pizza boxes out of your way and make yourself at home.
Could it have been the police looking for evidence?
No. We couldn't use evidence obtained that way. And besides, no one's that smart here. Only television cops do that sort of thing.
Good to know. Gotta run. My mac and cheese just binged.
I've got some paperwork to finish, and then I'm heading out. Where will I find you?
I'm gonna stay here. There weren't any death threats spray-painted on the walls, so maybe I'm just imagining things. I'm a little spooked, what with being accused of murder.
You're not accused yet, Morelli said. You're only under suspicion.
I hung up, stuffed my feet into the shearling boots, and pulled a hooded fleece sweatshirt over my head. I liked Morelli's house better than my apartment, but all my clothes and makeup and hair things were here. When Morelli spent the night with me, he borrowed my razor, used whatever soap was in the bathroom, and redressed in the clothes that hit the floor the night before. He kept some underwear and socks here, and that was it. When I stayed with Morelli, it was a whole production. I polished off the mac and cheese and washed it down with a beer. I was now warm inside and out, and no longer cared so much about the Dickie issue. I dropped a cheesy macaroni into Rex's food cup, and Rex was busy stuffing it into his cheek. His whiskers were whirring, and his tiny black eyes were bright. Time to go get a diggery, I said to Rex. Now that I'm full of mac and cheese, I can do anything. Leap tall buildings in a single bound, stop a speeding locomotive, get a bikini wax. Rex flicked a glance at me and scurried into his soup can. Chapter 5. It was mid-afternoon, and it was still gray and drizzly, but the drizzle wasn't freezing on the roads. I thought that was a good sign. I was on my way to the mall in Ranger's car and hat, and I was feeling very kick-ass. I was armed with a pepper spray and the stun gun. I had my cuffs. I had my paperwork. I was ready to do a takedown. I parked at the food court entrance and made a tour of the concessions. Pizza, burgers, ice cream, smoothies, Chinese, cookies, subs, Mexican, sandwiches. I didn't see Diggory. I did a fast scan of the tables and spotted him on the far side against a wall.
He was talking to someone, and there were papers spread across the table. I got a diet soda and found an empty table just behind Diggory. He was busy talking and didn't notice me. He seemed to be filling out some sort of form. He finished the form, gave it to the woman across from him. She gave him some money and left. A new person immediately sat down and gave Diggory a large yellow envelope. I wasn't taking any chances with this. I wasn't going to give Diggory an opportunity to bolt and run. I quietly moved to Diggory and clapped a bracelet on his right wrist. Diggory looked down at the cuff and then up at me.
"Fuck," Diggory said.
"You need to get rebonded," I told him. "You missed your court date."
"I'm conducting business now," Diggory said. "A little respect, okay? I don't come barging into your office, do I?"
"This isn't an office, it's a food court. What the heck are you doing?"
"He's doing my taxes," the woman across from him said. "He does them every year."
I looked at the woman. "You let him do your taxes?"
"He's certifiable."
Couldn't argue with that. "He's also under arrest," I told her. "You're going to have to make other arrangements."
"What arrangements? I can't do these forms. I can't figure them out."
Four more people came forward, three men and a woman.
"What's going on?" one of the men asked. "What's the holdup?"
"Simon has to leave now," I told him.
"No way. I've been waiting for an hour and I'm next in line. You want a piece of Simon? Take a number."
"Get up," I said to Simon.
"It's going to get ugly," Simon said. "You don't want to piss off Oscar over there. He don't got a lot of patience, and he's missing his afternoon TV shows to do this."
"I can't believe you're doing taxes."
"It was just one of them things that mushroomed. Not that it should be so surprising, since I have a very strong entrepreneurial side to me."
I looked at my watch. "If we hustle, I can get you bonded out today, and you can be back here in a couple hours."
"I'm not waiting no more couple hours,"
Oscar said, giving me a shot to the shoulder that knocked me into the woman behind me. I took the stun gun out of my coat pocket.
"Back off," I said to Oscar. "Simon is in violation of his bond, and he needs to go with me." "I've got one of those, too," the woman behind me said, and zing.
When I came around, I was on my back on the floor, and I was looking at the rent-a-cop from the lingerie trip with Grandma.
"Are you okay?" he said. "Did you have a spell? Can you get a flashback from one of them stun guns?"
"It's my life," I said to him. "It's complicated." He dragged me up and set me in a chair.
"Do you want water or something?"
"Yeah, water would be good." By the time he came with the water, the clanging in my head had almost completely stopped. I sipped the water and looked around. No Diggory. His clients were gone too, no doubt moved on to a taco stand or gas station. I felt my pockets. I was missing my cuffs and stun gun. I was probably lucky they hadn't taken my shoes and my watch. I retreated to the parking lot and carefully maneuvered the car onto the highway. I drove on autopilot and suddenly realized I was stopped in front of my parents' house. I checked to make sure I was no longer drooling, and I went into the house. My dad was in front of the television, sound asleep with a paper draped over his stomach. My mother and grandmother were in the kitchen cooking.
Grandma was wearing tight black spandex yoga pants and a pink t-shirt that said, "I'm sassy," and she dyed her hair red.
My mother was at the stove, but the ironing board was up and the iron was plugged in. I suspected it was the red hair that got the iron out. Since the iron was already out, I decided I'd just jump in. "So," I said to Grandma, "how'd the date go?"
"It was pretty good," Grandma said. "The funeral parlor had a new cookie, chocolate with white chocolate chips, and they did a real good job with Harry Rosinski. You couldn't hardly tell half his nose was eaten away with the skin cancer."
"Was he wearing jewelry?"
"No, but Lorraine Birnbaum was next door in viewing room number 4, and she was all decked out. She was wearing a real nice-looking watch, and they left her wedding band and diamond on her. The diamond was real big, too. You probably don't remember Lorraine. She moved away when you were little. She came back to live with her daughter after her husband died last year, but she didn't last too long. Her memorial said she was being buried on Friday."
"Did Elmer behave himself?"
"Yeah, that was the only disappointment. I was ready to put out, but he got some acid reflux from the cookies and had to go home."
My mother was at the stove sauteing ground beef for stuffed peppers. She reached for the cupboard where she kept her liquor stash, paused, and pulled herself together and went on with the sauteing.
"Sissy Cramp and I went shopping today," Grandma said, "and I got these new clothes and went to the beauty parlor. I thought I should spruce up since Elmer has all that nice black hair. It's a marvel that at his age he hasn't got a gray hair on his head.
He hasn't got any hair on his head, I told Grandma. He wears a wig.
That would explain a lot of things, Grandma said.
My mother and I looked at each other and shared a grimace.
I read where red is the hot color for hair this year, Grandma said, so I had Dolly do me red this time. What do you think?
I think it's fun, I told Grandma. It brings out the color in your eyes. I could see my mother bite into her lower lip, and I knew she was eyeing the liquor cabinet again.
It makes me feel like a whole new person, Grandma said. Sissy says I look just like Shirley MacLaine.
I zipped my jacket. I just stopped in to say hello. I have to get back to the office. I checked myself out in the hall mirror on my way to the door to make sure there were no leftover effects from the stun gun, like my tongue hanging out or my eyes rolling around in my head. I didn't notice anything, so I left my parents' house, buckled myself into the Cayenne, and called Lula.
Uh-huh, Lula said.
I'm gonna check on Carl Coughlin. Wanna ride along with me?
Sure. Maybe I could explode another squirrel on myself.
5 minutes later, I picked her up in front of the Bond's office.
Now this is what I call a car, Lula said, getting into the Cayenne. Only one place you'll get a car like this.
It's Ranger's.
Don't I know it. I get a rush just sitting in it. I swear that man is so hot and so fine, it's like he isn't even human.
Hmm, I said.
Hmm? What's that supposed to mean? You think he isn't fine?
He involved me in a murder.
He told you to choke Dickie in front of the whole law office staff?
Well, no, not exactly.
Not that Dickie don't deserve getting choked.
Dickie's scum.
Fucking A, Lula said.
Though it would appear I'm the sole beneficiary in his will.
Say what?
Apparently he had a will drawn up when we were married, making me heir, and he never got around to changing it.
How do you know that?
Joyce has a copy. She told the police about it, and they brought me in for questioning.
Then it's Joyce that involved you in this murder.
Yes.
Bitch, Lula said.
I drove up Hamilton and pointed the Porsche toward North Trenton. It was 4 o'clock, and another day was slipping by without a capture. If this continued, I'd have to scrounge around for another job, at least something part-time.
What's the plan here? Lula wanted to know.
If he's home, we grab him and cuff him and drag him to the car. You have cuffs, right?
Not with me. You're the big deal bounty hunter. You're supposed to have the cuffs.
I lost my cuffs.
Again? Honest to goodness, I've never seen anybody lose things like you.
You usually have cuffs, I said to Lula.
They're sort of attached to my bed. Tank was over, and we got playful.
Eek. Either one of them in handcuffs attached to a bed wasn't a good picture. I didn't realize you were a couple.
We're one of them couples who don't see each other all the time. We just see each other some of the time, and sometimes it goes to once in a while.
Okay, then we grab Coughlin and stun gun him. Do you have your stun gun?
Sure, I got my stun gun.
Lula pulled her stun gun out of her big purse.
Uh-oh, low battery.
I knew she had her Glock, and I knew it was loaded, but I didn't especially want her to shoot Coughlin.
How about I grab him and sit on him until he gives up, Lula said.
I guess that would work. I cruised down Coughlin Street and idled in front of his house. Lights were off inside. I drove around the block and scoped out the back of the house. No car parked in the alley. I cut the engine and Lula and I got out and walked to Coughlin's back door. I rapped on the door and announced myself. No answer. Lula had her hand on the doorknob.
It's unlocked, she said, pushing the door open, stepping inside. This guy's real trustin'.
Maybe he never came back. We went room by room, flipping lights on, looking around. The stuffed animals were everywhere. He had an entire bedroom filled with pigeons.
Who would want a stuffed pigeon? Lula asked. I mean, what sort of market do you suppose there is for a dead pigeon?
We went back downstairs, made our way out to the porch showroom, and Lula stopped in front of a beaver.
Look at this bad boy, Lula said. Now this is what I'm talking about. This here's the biggest fucking rodent ever lived. This is practically prehistoric.
I'd never seen a beaver up close and personal, and I was surprised at the size. Do you suppose they're always this big?
Maybe crazy Coughlin overstuffed it.
Lula picked up a remote that had been placed beside the beaver. The remote had two buttons. One of the buttons was labeled Eyes, and the other button was labeled Bang. Lula pressed the button labeled Eyes, and the beaver's eyes glowed.
She pressed it again, and the eyes shut off.
Probably I don't want to press the bang button, Lula said. This here looks to me like a exploding beaver, and it's not like it's some second-rate squirrel. This mother's gonna make a mess. This is atomic. This is something you only give to the enemy.
I looked over at Lula and smiled.
I know what you're thinking, Lula said. You're thinking of Joyce and how she deserves this beaver. You're thinking we have an obligation to give this beaver to Joyce.
She likes animals.
Yeah, especially big trained dogs and ponies.
Maybe the second button doesn't explode it. Maybe the beaver sings a song or something.
The button says bang.
It could be mislabeled.
I see where you're going, Lula said. You're thinking we have to say a lot of Hail Marys if we send this to Joyce and explode it on her. But it wouldn't be our fault if it exploded accidental, or if there was a misunderstanding on our part.
I wouldn't want to maim her.
Course not.
Just because she shot at me, zapped me with a stun gun, and ratted me out to the police, isn't any reason to do her bodily harm.
Whatever.
Still, it would be fun to send her a singing beaver. Lula looked at her watch.
How long are we going to stand here doing this rationalizing shit? I got stuff to do.
I scrounged around in my purse and came up with $8.40. I left it on the table and pocketed the remote.
What's that? Lula wanted to know.
It's for the beaver. I'm in enough trouble. I don't want to be accused of stealing a singing beaver.
And you think it's worth $8.40?
It's all I've got. I wrapped my arms around the beaver and hefted it off the table.
This weighs a ton.
Lula got her hands under his butt and helped me to the door. We loaded the beaver into the Cayenne cargo area and drove it across town to Joyce's house. Joyce lives in a big white colonial with fancy columns and a large yard. The house is a result of her last divorce. Joyce got the house and her husband got a new lease on life. There was a red Jeep in the driveway and lights were shining in the downstairs windows. Lula and I dragged the beaver out of the back of the Cayenne and lugged it to Joyce's front porch. We set the beaver down, I rang the bell, and Lula and I ran for cover. We hunkered down behind the red Jeep and gulped air. The front door opened and Joyce said,
"What on earth?"
I pushed the button to make the eyes glow and I peeked around the car. Joyce was bent over looking at the beaver. A man came up behind her, not Dickie, a younger, chunkier guy in jeans and a thermal t-shirt.
"What is it?"
he asked.
"It's a beaver." "Well, bring it inside," he said. "I like beaver."
Joyce pushed and pulled the beaver inside.